It's the 21st Show. I'm Brian Mackey. This week, after months of buildup, the Congress voted to take back some $9 billion in funding the government already allocated. Foreign aid programs are what's mainly affected, but the package also removes more than $1 billion from the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. The CPB, in turn, passes most of that money on to NPR, PBS, and member stations, including the one that produces this program, Illinois Public Media. Under the circumstances, we're starting our weekly political review with the latest federal news and Illinois Public Media's Washington correspondent, Linda Kenyon. Linda, thanks for being here.
Thank you, Brian.
So we're going to spend the entire hour on Monday talking more about the ways this so-called rescission vote is going to hit closer to home for public media here in Illinois. But big picture, what effect is this going to have on public broadcasting?
Well, it's already had some effects, certainly, if nothing else, a chilling effect about what's going to happen, what programming changes need to be made. The Corporation for Public Broadcasting is not the only funding source for PBS and NPR, but it is a major funding source. And that means that certain programs may be cut. Already we're seeing some cuts that came in anticipation of this a clawback of money, if you will, through this rescissions package. And we expect that it has and already will lead to some layoffs of personnel.
This is something that some Republicans have wanted to do since the Nixon administration. There was a major effort under Newt Gingrich when he was speaker in the 1990s. What made it different this time, in your view, that finally allowed this to happen?
Well, we have a Republican president, we have a Republican-controlled Senate, and a Republican-controlled House. The Republican-controlled government, per se, with the President Trump at the helm, has long complained, accusing public media, NPR, PBS, of furthering liberal views, liberal values that the current administration does not agree with. So rather than allow people to pick and choose what they want to see or hear on the radio or television, the administration has decided that it must essentially fall in line with certain philosophies. And that, in turn, led to these cuts.
And I will say, public media is not alone in being a target of an attack from this president and this administration. We've seen lawsuits with ABC and CBS and other outlets. Let's talk a little, though, about the procedure here, since you are an expert in congressional action. We got a question from a listener, Lisa in Champaign, who asks if we can explain what's happened to the filibuster in the Senate throughout Biden's term. And in recent memory, she writes, it seems like it, oddly, almost always required 60 votes for anything to get done there. And now, all of a sudden, 50 vote ties are being broken and won by Vice President Vance voting just to get a majority vote, like in what just happened with the rescission vote. Why don't the Democrats also have the cover of the filibuster, she asks. Thank you for that question, Lisa. Linda, I'll put that to you.
Yeah, a really good question. A lot of people have been asking. There's a difference between the rescissions process and the reconciliation process, both of which require just a simple majority to pass. Now, rescissions, which we're talking about now with the cuts to NPR and PBS, for example, that was done under what is known as the Impoundment Control Act. That means you impound the funds that were already allocated by Congress. You claw them back, which is a term they love so much in Washington.
And this is because I guess Nixon wanted to not spend all the money that Congress, the Democratic Congress, had approved for him in the 70s, right?
Right, right. And of course, as you know, Congress has the power of the purse. And so that became an issue about separation of powers. For rescissions, it becomes a situation where it's certainly with this president, we have, disagreement with some of the money that was allocated by Congress. So it will be rescinded under this Impoundment Control Act, which can pass only by a simple majority in both the House and the Senate, therefore making it filibuster proof. When we saw the passage of the President's Big Beautiful Bill Act, that was done under a process called reconciliation, quite different. That was also only a simple majority, also filibuster proof. What it does is it changes the law And it allows, in other words, under very strict rules, to change the way that money is allocated. So it's different than the rescissions, which claws back money that was already allocated.
And, and I will say, yeah, this idea of reconciliation, we don't have to get too far into the weeds, but it has been used under Democratic control as well. I think the Inflation Reduction Act, the big Biden infrastructure bill, was also done through reconciliation, if I remember correctly.
Yes, that's correct. You know, and of course, you know, the filibuster, which is the tool that gives the minority party extreme powers in the Senate. But two-thirds is only required for certain things, like overriding a presidential veto or proposing constitutional amendments, ratifying treaties, impeachments as well, expelling members from the House or the Senate, suspending the rules in the House or the Senate, ending a filibuster in the Senate, and also determining whether a president is able to discharge the powers and duties of the office under the 25th Amendment. So filibuster is a very powerful tool for the minority. But if something is taken up under the rescissions, or in this case, with the big, beautiful bill, for example, under reconciliation, it's just a simple majority.
Can we also talk, changing subjects here in the time we have remaining, about the Justice Department's decision not to release files related to the late sex offender and financier Jeffrey Epstein? This is something President Trump talked a lot about as a candidate, and now he's attacking his own supporters over it. And I want to say, I know this might seem like a salacious sort of scandal-mongering story, but I do think there's a bigger picture issue here of a president who frequently, you know, sort of empowers people who have sort of conspiracy theory-type views in his, you know, his actual cabinet, as well as sort of in his kitchen cabinet, his informal advisors. And now those people are pretty angry with his administration. And you're in the White House a lot. I wonder how you're seeing this affect the president and Republicans more broadly.
The president's pretty angry about the focus on Jeffrey Epstein. He has lashed out at Republicans and Democrats alike, and he certainly, as is his practice, has lashed out at reporters for asking about it. He had the Crown Prince of Bahrain in the Oval Office this week, and he said, when asked about Epstein, he said, it's a hoax, and he said it's started by the Democrats and it's been run by the Democrats for 4 years. He said, this is a quote, some stupid Republicans and foolish Republicans fall into the net, and so they try and do the Democrats' work. The Democrats are good for nothing other than these hoaxes. Now, it's interesting when he also says that he no longer needs the support of his, in his words, past supporters. He says they have bought into this bull bleep, hook, line, and sinker. You understand that I put in the word bleep there because we won't say it on the radio. But this is what the president has been saying, either in the Oval Office or on social media. And he has he's really wants this Epstein situation to go away, perhaps because of the possibility that there might be some connection between him and Epstein, which he denies. But
well, we know there's a connection, right? There's photos of them together. There was a Wall Street Journal story. Apparently, he wrote a sort of a bawdy letter to Epstein for this big birthday book in 2003. I guess the question is, was he part of Epstein's sort of depraved activities on his private island in the Caribbean?
Right. And he wants this all to go away. And the more he wants it to go away, the more it keeps resurfacing. And he's having a hard time with his MAGA base and with his some of his most loyal supporters, for example, the FBI Director Kash Patel and his deputy Don Bongino, who want the full Epstein files released. And we hear alternately from the Attorney General Pam Bondi that she had the full file on her desk. She had a client list on her desk. Then she said there was no client list. And back and forth it goes. And people are frustrated about this.
Well, this will be an interesting one to continue watching. Linda Kenyon, Illinois Public Media's Washington correspondent, thanks for all you do.
Thank you.
It's the 21st Show. I'm Brian Mackey. Now to state politics, where some of the candidates running in next year's primary election are already collecting a lot of cash for their campaigns. There are a number of high-profile races. Voters across Illinois will choose who gets to succeed Dick Durbin as U.S. Senator. Two more House seats are open because the current office holders, Raja Krishnamurti and Robin Kelly, are running in that Senate race. Jan Schakowsky is retiring at the end of her term, so there are several people campaigning to take her place as well. Meanwhile, state controller Susana Mendoza says she is not running for re-election, but she is leaving the door open to running, again, for mayor of Chicago. Here to talk about all this and more is Jeremy Gorner, who covers Illinois government for the Chicago Tribune. Jeremy, welcome back to the show.
Hey, Brian. Hope all's well.
Thanks. Given the circumstances, you know, we're still here. Let's start with Susana Mendoza's decision. Yeah. She hasn't said for sure whether she's running for mayor again. This may sound a little harsh, but what reason does she have to think that she'd come in higher than fifth place as she did when she ran in 2019?
Well, you know, when Brandon Johnson won a couple of years ago, he's a staunch progressive, right? He got a lot of the younger voters backed him, and he was kind of a wave of progressive politicians who we saw get elected to office, you know, not just in Chicago, but in Illinois. I mean, we've seen this in the General Assembly, in the last 4 or 5 years, and he is pretty much a continuation of that, of course, on the Chicago level. But what we've seen in the last couple of years, there's a lot of voters in the city who are dissatisfied with his leadership. He reportedly has a low approval rating. The city's finances are pretty shaky. And because of that, you have the chief fiscal officer for the state of Illinois, in Susana Mendoza, regularly going on social media criticizing the way that Johnson is running the city. You figure she's the state comptroller. She should be sticking to state issues such as, being the steward for fiscal responsibility in the state and steward of the state's finances and so on and so forth. But really what most of the rhetoric you hear from Susana Mendoza these days is her criticism of government in the city of Chicago, particularly the Johnson administration. So she's really positioning herself as someone. So I think like what political observers may see is that you have a progressive, a new wave of progressives like Brandon Johnson in charge of a major city. And you may see that there are people out there who think that that experiment hasn't been working too well in Chicago and that maybe it's time for a change. Maybe there's some people who think that the mayor of Chicago, you know, who's going to be a Democrat, should be somewhere, more in the middle, more moderate. And that's what Susana Mendoza is. I mean, she's more of a moderate Democrat. She's been around in the political landscape in Illinois for 20 plus years. She's a former state rep. She was a city clerk during Mayor Rahm Emanuel's administration. She's just got, a wealth of experience. Now, why she finished in fifth place, several years ago, one of the things she said basically is that, she's had a lot to learn in the last several years since that election and basically has grown as a politician, as someone who could, basically not repeat some of those same mistakes if she were to go on the campaign trail again as mayor. But she thinks that she has an opening now, really, just because we've seen what somebody who's to the left of her, we've seen what that leadership looks like in Chicago, and there's a lot of people who aren't happy about it.
Yeah, well, that'll be one we're definitely going to follow ahead. Let's leave some time because we have about 3 minutes remaining, and maybe we can do each of the big races that are still outstanding. Let's go to the Senate race, right? I've already mentioned Robin Kelly, Raja Krishnamurti, both members of Congress. There's also Juliana Stratton, the lieutenant governor.
Sure.
We have some insight, though, into the fundraising for each of those campaigns. How's it going?
Raja Krishnamurti is way ahead of Lieutenant Governor Stratton and Robin Kelly. He's got around $21 million in his campaign coffers, and he's been raising money for a long time, way before he declared that he wanted Dick Durbin's Senate seat. And you have Robin Kelly, who's got maybe around $2 million in the bank. And Juliana Stratton has, just a little over $1 million. Now, the advantage that Kelly and Krishnamurti have is that, they've been federal office holders for a long time. So they've had a lot of time to raise money in the on the federal level, much longer time than Juliana Stratton has. Now, you might also think, well, she's got the endorsement of Governor Pritzker, who's one of the most influential, if not the most influential Democrat in the state. But, you know, so that remains to be seen exactly how much voters are going to be swayed by a mere endorsement from Governor Pritzker. I believe she also got some donations from Jerry Reinsdorf, Laura Ricketts, you know, a couple high profile folks in the sports world. But at the same time,
she's getting some legislative endorsements this week too. Speaker of the House, I saw she put out
there. Yeah. Speaker Welch endorsed her, a number of state senators, number of state reps. So she's getting, you know, a lot of people who she's worked with in state government. You know, but at the same time, yeah, I mean, her what she's her campaign fundraising abilities so far pale in comparison to Krishnamurthy and Robin Kelly so far. I mean, just because you raise more money, as you know, Brian, doesn't mean that you're going to win the election. Certainly helps. And Governor Pritzker being a billionaire, that might not help too much. We'll have to see, because there's going to be limits in this election cycle on what he can give as well. So
That's a really good point, because like in the state, unlimited spending, Wild West. But with the federal government, there are still restrictions, at least for, you know, sort of hard dollars, as they call it. Right.
Yeah. Right. And I believe he was only able to give like a $7,000 donation this, you know, this time around for her, which was a limit. So, you know, so there's that. It's not like you said on the state level where they're a little more liberal with the caps.
Yeah. Well, we have the money to talk about now. We'll have the endorsements to continue talking about. Hopefully we'll have some debates at some point. And then next year, people will actually get to vote and we'll have a real poll for how that race is going to shape up. Jeremy Gorner, right. I know you'll be covering every step of the way at the Chicago Tribune. Thanks so much for being with us and sharing your reporting with us today on the 21st show.
Thanks, Brian.
And we will have to get to some of those other races I talked about, Representative Schakowsky and Kelly and Krishnamurthy's vacant seats, on a future program. Let us know what you want us to cover. Talk at 21stshow.org. We'll be right back. This is the 21st Show.